Hi there. We'll get started and we'll wrap other people in as they come. And my name is John Beck, and I co-director a daily work at Data Lives, which has been here on campus for almost 25 years. And next year is the 20th year of the Brown Bag Series, so we're beginning to put that together, and we'll be grabbing friends old and new to include in that specific lineup for next year for our 20th year. We only have one more brown bag after today for the rest of the semester, and then we take the summer off. And I'll just start these around. Peter Cole is a wonderful scholar who does work in both the U.S. and South Africa. So his is going to be a comparative brown bag on the 24th, 2 weeks from today, called On the Waterfront in Durban and San Francisco, Longshoremen and Social Movement Unionism, 1934 to 1994. And Peter is at the History Department at Western Illinois University and a very, very good scholar. And I really would commend that to all of you. Do come back. I think you'll not regret being in the audience for Peter's brown bag. The other thing I would announce, and I forgot to bring flyers for it, but next week, I believe it's next week, is Golden Land, which is being done at the RCAH. And it's a play that's based on the uprising of the 20,000, which was a lady garment workers strike early in the 20th century, followed 2 years later in 1911 by the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. And both of those are involved in the play, and it's an unbelievably well-written play by a senior at the Residential College, Jenny Crakes, and I think that it's going to definitely be worth the $5 admission, and it starts next Thursday and runs through Sunday over in the RCAH auditorium, I believe. So today, it's been my pleasure to have the last few years my wonderful colleague, Maita Tapia, who came to us from Cornell, and when we interviewed Dr. Tapia, the thing that came through loud and clear was, number one, she was a first-rate scholar, and number two, she was at the cutting edge of trying to figure out what worker movements and the future labor movement were really going to look like. And she's done a lot of research in that regard. We're going to hear more than simply about fast food workers today, though that is in the original title, because the fact that it's a fast-growing, fast-evolving kind of set of organizations, set of movements, and it's, I think it's still, at least from my reading, struggling to find what, you know, what the, all of the organizational models are going to look like and what they end up boiling down to, and I think we'll hear a lot of that today. She's been an absolutely a wonderful colleague, so I was very happy to put the handcuffs on her early to come and speak to our daily work, our daily lives. So today, she'll be talking on the topic, Organizing the Fragmented, Workers, Unions, and the Fast Food Industry. So please help me give a warm welcome to Dr. Maita Tapia.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you all for coming here on this Friday afternoon. So as John mentioned, I'm a faculty at the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations here at MSU, and my work mainly revolves around labor movements, trade unions, but also alternative forms of collective representation, such as worker centers, community organizations, and I look at them mostly in the US as well as in European countries. And I'm very much interested in their strategies, their campaigning, the way they mobilize the members. And so today I'll talk about two kind of relatively recent campaigns and movements that are kind of going on specifically in the US. Yes, do you have a question? I was already wondering what question you would have. So I'll talk about two recent campaigns that you probably heard of. So one is the fast food campaign, the Fight for 15 movement, as it is often being called. And then the other one is the campaigning that goes on by Walmart associates. One of them is called Our Walmart, standing for Organization United for Respect at Walmart. So, and here, as I'll allude to, as I'll talk about later, what you can see already in a fast food campaign is what they're trying to do, the workers, is kind of show the contradiction between the enormous wealth on the one part, in terms of the corporations, and then the poor conditions for the workers. So you see a worker shining the shoes of Ronald McDonald to kind of show the contradictions in a capitalist society. Okay, so why are these movements important? Let's just start with kind of the background that a lot of you are familiar with. But so the United States has the fourth highest inequality level of the OECD, and that's after Chile, Mexico, and Turkey. Income inequality is often measured by the Gini coefficient, which means that the closer to zero means that everyone has an equal wage, and the closer to one is one person has the most income. And so United States has a high income inequality. Another measure of income inequality is kind of comparing the richest 10% to the poorest 10%. And so again, these are the yellow dots in the U.S. That's the third highest of all OECD countries. So it's the richest 10% is about 16 times higher than the poorest 10%. And on average for the OECD, it's about 9.6. So it's a lot higher for the U.S. In addition to that, it's not only that the income inequality is high, but it has also been rising faster than a lot of other countries over the past decades. And so why is this important, this income inequality? And you'll hear it a lot in policy debates. But so it's not only that you could say it's morally wrong that there's such a gap in terms of income inequality, but it's also bad economics. So clearly when people earn less, they don't spend enough, so businesses have fewer consumers. That's one argument that has been made. It's also bad politics. So it breeds social resentment. There can be uprisings. Clearly, there's something wrong with it, and one might argue we need policy reforms, we need certain legislation in place to make sure that there's not that big of a gap, better tax systems, and so on. But that's often hard to do. One of the reasons is because our political actors, think of, for example, our presidential candidates now, are very much tied to big corporations. They're very much tied to the financial elites. And therefore, even though they might say income inequality is wrong, it's often very unclear what they will actually do about it to make the gap not as wide. And so that's why I would argue that it's important to look at kind of outside pressures and what's happening from the outside. Certain movements like the fast food movement, like the Walmart movement, are trying to do something about that and trying to fight for better working and living conditions. So another very well-known graph is kind of, one might call it the social contract. And as you can tell, wages, productivity kind of went hand in hand from the 40s till the mid-70s. That's mainly because of the New Deal, of course. You had also collective bargaining. You had strong unions that made sure that there were good working conditions. But then what happened is productivity went up and wages stagnated. And so again, one of the factors that is often mentioned, the reason because of this gap is because trade unions became much weaker. You don't have the institutions there anymore. You don't have these strong collective bargaining agreements anymore that make sure that also the wages of workers go hand in hand up with productivity. And so the current context, if you look at it today, many people are very pessimistic about the state of the labor movement, the state of the unions. So there's a very low union membership. If you look at the statistics, it's about 11% in the US, and the private sector just about 6%. However, there's some room for optimism in the sense that not all workers that are organized are actually counted under these statistics. So you have workers that are organized but are not part of this traditional labor movement, traditional union. And you can think about worker centers, domestic workers, certain restaurant workers form groups, like Restaurant Opportunity Center is one example. So they are organized, they try to push for better wages, but not under the traditional kind of collective bargaining agreement. And so what we see, in a sense, and the good news, is that there are these local initiatives, there's experimentation, there's innovations in trying to improve working and living conditions for workers. And so my question here in both of these campaigns that I'll look at, the fast food and Walmart, is kind of what kind of strategies do these alternative forms of representation actually use to get to better conditions. Okay, so I'll talk, as I said earlier, I'll talk about the fast food campaign and then also a little bit about Walmart. So first, in terms of the fast food sector, so there's clearly been a shift over the past decades to more of a low-wage economy. Whereas decades ago, the big companies were General Electric, U.S. Steel, and they paid above median household income. Today, big companies like fast food companies, like Walmart, they're the biggest companies and they pay minimum wage or even under minimum wage. So that's kind of a shift from, let's say, a high road economy in the 50s, 60s to more of a low road, a low wage economy, impacting a lot of workers. So looking more specifically in fast food, so for the US, it had record profits in 2013, a $200 billion industry. It's also one of the fastest growing in terms of employment, but then also one of the lowest paid. So they often call them McJobs because they're kind of based on starvation wages, not enough hours. The median hourly wage is under $9 an hour, and the majority receives no benefits such as healthcare. And so as a consequence, and McDonald's, for example, pays very little to a worker, so that worker then actually relies on government benefits like food stamps that cost taxpayers about $7 billion a year. In addition, 70% of the fast food workers are above the age of 20, and on average they're 20 years old. So it's a myth that fast food workers are these teenagers that just, you know, do this as a temporary job. And then also more than a fourth of the workers are raising at least one child. So there's actually many families involved among the workers. Almost 90% are frontline occupations, so very little scope or space actually to for upward mobility. So they kind of stay in cashier jobs. And finally, surveys have shown that almost 90% of these fast food workers have been victim of wage theft. So if we look at the industry structure of fast food, what can we see? It's very much based on a franchising model. So it's an increasing degree of fragmentation called, by David Weil, called fissuring of the employment relationship. This means that rather than having the McDonald's, the big corporation, as your employer, it's all cut up into little franchisees. So for example, for McDonald's, over 80% of the McDonald's are owned and operated by franchisees and not by McDonald's itself. What that means is that legally speaking, these franchisees are independent. However, many would argue that there is strong control from corporate. And the question now will become, what extent, how much control do they actually have? So corporate, for example, can decide, okay, we want to have this kind of toast for breakfast. Then within a very short time frame, they can push that through to every franchisee so it's the same everywhere. You know, we want you to smile when you see a customer. They will push these kind of policies through to every franchisee. As I'll show later, McDonald's, the corporation, will of course argue that they cannot, that they don't have any control over wages, over benefits, that that's all part of the franchisee, so they don't have anything to do with that. But workers, of course, will dispute this kind of relationship. So again, the fast food industry is the most highly franchised, and if you look at the extent of unionization, it's very, very low. It's just about 1%. So the majority of workers do not have any type of collective voice or collective representation within fast food. And so the question is, how do you actually organize workers in this in such a fragmented industry? So legally speaking, this means because it's franchisees, you would have to do it franchisee by franchisees. And so there are over 3,000. So that would have to, you would have to try to unionize, organize over 3,000 of these little McDonald's, which is an unfeasible and of course very hard to do. So the question that is often raised is, who is the employer of these workers? Is it the franchisee, or is it the big McDonald's that can actually decide about the wages and the benefits? And so it's an interesting case because of the legality of it, you would think, why do these fast food workers actually go on strike? It's impossible to organize them because you would have to go unit by unit. So what are they trying to achieve, and is it actually working? So in general, if we think about power of workers, what kind of power do these fast food workers have, actually? And you would think at first glance they don't have any power. And the reason why is because often you would refer to, do workers have structural power? This means that because of their position in the economic system, they have a lot of power, and so they can actually demand certain political or economic concessions from the employer. Think about, for example, pilots. If pilots go on strike, you can't just put another person in there because they have high skill, so they have a lot of structural power. Think about, for example, the sit-down strike in Flint in the 1930s. They had a lot of power because that was a key node in the supply chain, and if they stopped production there, everything else kind of stopped and got blocked. So that's another reason they had a lot of structural power. If you think about the fast food workers, they're often seen as low-skilled, low-paid, very easily replaceable, so they don't have that type of structural power. So what other types of power then are there? What about associational power? That means that because a worker is part of a big union, has a big kind of union behind it, that's why they have a lot of power. But as I mentioned earlier, the union density in the fast food sector is barely 1%. So they don't have that either. So if you think, okay, they don't have structural power, they don't have a big union behind them, so where do they get their power? What kind of power do they have to go on strike? And what I argue based on Chun's work earlier is that they have symbolic power. What I mean by that is that what they try to do is get away from the legality and from labor law, but kind of engage into highly public demonstrations, public actions to demand legitimacy from the public rather than narrowly looking at the law of what's possible. And as we interviewed some people in the course of this project, one of the arguments would indeed be, if we have to wait for labor law to adjust to our situation, we're going to wait forever. So we need to do something else to go beyond that. And so that's the type of symbolic struggle, is really making it more into a public debate of why people should be doing better. And that's what they're trying to do with these strikes. And so the fast food campaign, so how it got started, the demands, the tactics. So first it got started kind of in New York City and Chicago with community organizations. They were trying different tactics. It's not that someone was just sitting in their room and thinking, oh, let's organize fast food. It didn't really happen like that. They were trying, you know, they were talking to fast food workers, they were talking to pizza delivery people, they were talking to a range of people, and then eventually fast food kind of caught on. So their main demands is $15 an hour, as well as unionization without retaliation. The tactics, so what they do, it's based on what you could see as minority unionism. That means that they will mobilize workers, even though it's just a minority still of the workers. It's not like everyone among fast food workers agrees with this, but they will go ahead anyway. What they do is they have these geographically coordinated one-day strikes. It started in 2012 in August in New York City. They had the first strike on one day. On that day, they also flew in workers from other cities that would join in these strikes to learn about, okay, how do you do that? What does it take? And so these one-day strikes are really kind of flash tactics. They want to raise the awareness. And so the next one is coming up on April 15th. And so they had a range of these over the past 2 years. And every time, more cities, more workers got involved. So in a way, it's growing, but it's still just this one day, like in and out in that sense. What they also do, part of their tactics, is these class action lawsuits. So they have been suing McDonald's, and not just the franchisee, but also McDonald's, the corporation, arguing that it's a joint employer. They have been suing them for wage theft. They have been suing them for not complying with health and safety. For example, they argue that when they got burns, there wasn't any first aid kit. They just were told to put some mustard or mayonnaise on it. Things like that. So they sue a lot of lawsuits, and their tactic is to sue not just against the franchisee, but again, also suing against McDonald's as if McDonald's is their employer, and kind of trying to get that image across. And then also, while it's a lot of community organizations that are part of it, it's also clear that the big union, the public service sector union, SEIU, is supporting that movement. I do this together, this research with my colleague from Ohio State University. And so we've, Tashlin Lakhani, and so what happened is that we had success in interviewing community organizers that are part of this movement, but it was very hard to get people from the SEIU to talk. One of the reasons is, of course, that they don't want to really talk about the strategy that they have. They also want to remain a little bit more on the background and say, you know, this is not really a union thing. This is more of a broader workers' movement thing. And so SEIU in the media has sometimes been criticized, saying that they put a lot of dollars, some talk about $10 million in these campaigns, but act as if they're not really the leader or not driving it. So there's some tension there. So again, here, for example, you see that their slogans are also much broader. It's kind of framing it in terms of social justice, saying we are worth more, fight for 15. They also had placards saying, I am a man or I am a woman, referring to the Memphis sanitation strike with Martin Luther King Jr. So really putting this in a kind of a broader social justice context is also part of their strategy, saying that this is not just about fast food, but this is about everyone. This is about all us workers. And so, for example, on April 15, the next one, strikes will be happening, especially in big cities like Detroit, Chicago, New York, and not just by fast food workers, but now many other workers are actually joining. Healthcare workers, but also think of adjunct professors who also feel like they're in a position of precarity. So it goes across low skill, high skill, education level, and so on. So what are some of the successes so far? So first, you could argue that it definitely helped elevate the debate about inequality in the US. Also, it has been mobilizing low-wage workers across hundreds of cities in the US. So people don't just remain complacent, but actually come out, mobilize, get on the streets. Some states have raised the minimum wage, and Seattle actually implemented a higher minimum wage of $15 an hour. The Seattle case is important because, first, Seattle made a distinction between small employers with less than 500 employees and large employers with more than 500 employees. And they said, the city council said, small employers have more time to implement this minimum wage. Large employers have to do it faster. Now, the interesting part is that they argued that franchisees, like a small McDonald's, is seen as a large employer, even though these franchisees, of course, don't have 500 employees. They might have 5 or 10. The reason for that is that they argue that because a franchisor or a big corporation like McDonald's is behind them, they do get the resources to actually push through a higher minimum wage at a faster pace. The International Franchise Association tried to go against that, but it didn't work. And now, in addition, as at the time of speaking, so currently at the National Labor Relations Board, there are hearings underway to see whether McDonald's is actually a joint employer or not, because of all the lawsuits that have been brought forth. So this is, if McDonald's would be seen as a joint employer, that would definitely be a kind of a watershed moment in terms of the franchising structure, because that would mean that McDonald's becomes liable for issues of wage theft and so on. And also, one could think of even unionizing across these franchisees with one bargaining unit. That's probably still far away, but that's kind of the push that is happening here. In addition, so as I mentioned, it could actually redefine and reclassify the relationship between who is a worker and who is the employer. And really think about, is it just a franchisee, or does the franchisor, the big corporation McDonald's, have actually so much control over the franchisee that the latter could be seen as the employer? So what are some of the responses of the industry? Actually, very recently, McDonald's decided to raise the wages for the workers. They did this for a couple of reasons. So first, they raised the wages just for their own corporate-owned McDonald's. So again, trying to signal, you know, we raised the wages for our own McDonald's. We can't say anything about what franchisees have to do. So trying to signal again, we're not a joint employer. We're very separate from these other franchisees. Another reason why, and I'll talk about this later, is because recently Walmart, Target, and other big retail companies have raised the wage. And as you can imagine, these workers might float between a McDonald's and a Walmart, and so if Walmart raises wages, others have to follow. And that might be another reason why McDonald's started to raise wages. So they raise it for $1 above the minimum wage. In addition, some of the responses, so you have these TV commercials by McDonald's that show, that don't really focus on the product, on the hamburger, but focus on the young guy just from out, that still is in high school, that works at a McDonald's. So again, kind of trying to show the image of, it's a teenager that works here, so it's fine if he doesn't, you know, earn a ton of money. The Restaurant Association has kind of threatened, saying if we raise wages, we will shift to kind of more automated technology. It's often a classic kind of threat. Domino's would also as a big franchisor, would also say we're not responsible for the behavior of franchisees. Similarly, McDonald's would say franchisees determine the pay, and McDonald's pays above the minimum wage in most cases. In essence, the reaction has mostly been, we're not responsible, we're not liable, we don't have that kind of control. And so lawsuits that are happening now are really about what's the extent of control that McDonald's has over these franchisees. Okay, So to conclude with the fast food sector, so there is potential, actually, surprisingly, because if you would have said 10 years ago, you know, fast food workers will go on strike, no one might have believed you. Say, why? There's no power. What would they be able to achieve? So there is actually potential. And they use different strategies. So they use kind of these symbolic struggles to try to redefine the employment relationship. So they get outside, they try to raise the awareness, highly publicized demonstrations, these one-day strikes, coalition building between community organizations and unions are taking place, and then also a lot of political pressure. So for example, in Seattle, one of the people we spoke to would say, you know, rather than elevating the wage for 100 people at one workplace, we actually elevate it for 100,000 through the city council at once. So trying to put political pressure to raise minimum wage at city level, at state level, even President Obama, of course, talks about minimum wage rise. But there are many challenges to this, because one could, of course, think, how sustainable is this, these one-day strikes? What if the SEIU decides we don't have any money anymore, or we shift priorities, we're not going to support that movement anymore? What if they might get a minimum wage raise, but then what? If there's no institution or a union behind them, how sustainable is that? So these are questions that remain. And of course, it's always harder to do this in such a fragmented industry. Okay, so now let's shift focus a little bit. So let's go to Walmart. So Walmart has been in the news, of course, many times. This was, I think it was last Thanksgiving. At Walmart, they had, I think it was in Canton, Ohio, they had this stand saying, please donate food items here so associates in need can enjoy Thanksgiving dinner. So it came, of course, it's referring to the fact that, and this was put out by management. So Walmart workers are paid so little or not, or don't work enough hours, and as a consequence, they needed to rely on charity of others, of other associates, other workers, to actually make ends meet. So there's big power in these big box retail, especially Walmart. So it's the largest private sector employer in the US and the world. It's it has about 1.3 million employees in the US and 2.2 million overall, more than 11,000 stores, revenues that exceed those of Target, Home Depot, Sears, Kmart, Safeway, and Kroger combined. So of course, one of the reasons why sometimes people say, well, what about Target? They don't have any better working conditions. Why do we always focus on Walmart? And the reason is, of course, because it's sheer size. Walmart is just so big that it sets patterns for these other stores. So what about the labor conditions in the US? So as you probably know and already heard a lot about it, so it's often very, bad working conditions, so not enough working hours. I believe when they talk about full-time, they talk about 28 hours a week. So they say, Walmart would argue, 74% of our people work full-time, so that's a good thing. But then if you look at it, full-time for Walmart is just working 20 hours a week, which of course is again very hard to make ends meet. There's often cases of unpaid overtime. Also, one of their strategies, so they're often in more rural areas rather than urban centers, and what they rely on is kind of these underemployed women that were available at kind of a minimum wage. And that's similar to kind of the farm conditions that were in place before. So there's also very anti-union. They have a union prevention index. So from the moment they see that something is happening in terms of workers might try to organize, they fly in from Bentonville, Arkansas to prevent, or they just shut down that department. So there's a strong connection between Bentonville and Shenzhen. So Bentonville in Arkansas is where the headquarters of Walmart are. Shenzhen is in south east of China. It's now a really industrial hub. It's kind of called the new workshop of the world. Whereas think about it was Manchester maybe in the 19th century. You could think about Detroit in the early 20th century. So now it's Shenzhen. Often also with very poor working conditions, workers that sleep at just right next door of the factory, almost in slavery-like conditions. And so, whereas Walmart earlier prided itself on the fact that, you know, it's U.S. made, they pushed the suppliers so hard to always put down the cost that the suppliers couldn't do it anymore. So they pushed suppliers to just make it often in China, or just stop working with Walmart. But as you can imagine, for suppliers, if they lose a contract with Walmart, they often would just go bankrupt because that's their biggest customer. For example, for Procter & Gamble, Walmart is the biggest customer and is as big as the 9 next customers combined. So if Procter & Gamble would lose a contract with Walmart, it loses a lot of its profits or revenue. So what contributes to Walmart's growth? People might argue that Walmart just has been very innovative in terms of its business system, and it has been like that, for example, in terms of its supply chain. But on the other hand, it also is because it tries to dodge certain policies, it plays politics, and so there's a reason why Walmart can actually have these low prices. And so their slogan is always low prices, always. And so the reason why, of course, is because they often squeeze out the supplier that much and because they're so big they can do it, that's why they have these prices. So for example, in 2006, Walmart went to Germany and set up a Walmart there. Well, it actually didn't survive, and they had to close it down. And one of the reasons was that in Germany, they had to deal with trade unions and works councils and had to have certain wages. But of course, in their business model, that wasn't feasible. And so they had to pull out of Germany. And so if you look at the recent Walmart strikes, they're different actors. Warehouse Workers United, these are not the traditional trade unions. These are more alternative groups of workers that get together. But then the main trade union behind it is the UFCW, the United Food and Commercial Workers. And so again, what Walmart does is, one of the recent things that they did is these Black Friday protests. So again, this one-day protest on Black Friday, because of course it's very visible. They also put in a lot of wage and hour federal lawsuits, strikes at distribution centers. And these distribution centers are actually not operated by Walmart directly, but by a subcontractor. But what the Warehouse Workers United would argue is that Walmart has, again, such a control over these subcontractors that they can change the issue. And so this actually worked, and they got better conditions because these warehouse workers just stopped the movement of boxes, and so they had to do something. And also another strategy is, of course, coalition building between these trade unions and these alternative forms of collective representation. And again, one of the demands is this $15 an hour that comes up over and over again. So these are just some kind of groups and organizations that are pushing for better working conditions at Walmart. This is the Black Friday protests that they're happening in many places. They had some recent successes. One was called Respect the Bump. A pregnant woman was at first fired because they couldn't accommodate her, and then they protested, they mobilized workers, and in the wake of these protests, they came up with a policy to kind of accommodate pregnant women. Another one is in scheduling, so giving better hours. So while Walmart is, of course, not unionized, these organizations are able to push for maybe little but still significant changes in terms of the working conditions. And then also, as of recently, so Walmart will raise the wages of 500,000 workers in the US by instituting a $9 an hour starting rate in April, and that will increase to $10 in February 2016. And then again, because Walmart is so big, other companies start to follow. So TJ Maxx, Marshalls, Target, they follow and kind of follow that same pattern. One of the dangers is, of course, those workers ask for more. They ask for $15 an hour. While $15 might not be possible, at least not in the short term, what Walmart, in a way, tries to do is give them a little bit so that they would stop mobilizing, stop kind of fighting against the company. So it could be seen as kind of a management strategy, what often happens, to take the energy out of the campaign. So just to conclude, what I would argue is that there is a need for better working and living conditions, and then while maybe the traditional trade unions, you might think they're on the decline, there's actually a lot happening at a local level by these kind of alt-labor or alternative forms of working conditions. And so we see different strategies. They can use symbolic struggles to redefine the employment relationship. They can use structural power of these distribution centers, the coalition building that goes on, and political pressure. But again, there are many challenges, and one of them is to what extent are these strikes sustainable, especially if there's no kind of big union or institution behind it that makes it sustainable on the long term. Okay, thank you very much.
Well, I'm sure that everybody has a lot of questions or comments. I've got a bunch written down, so let me just open the floor. Comments or questions so far? Peter.
Yeah. You want me to answer it first?
Yeah, okay. Take each in turn, that'd be fine.
Okay. That's a
probably don't know what their plan is, their strategic document.
Yeah, I wish. Yeah. No, it's a good question. So as of now, they kind of use the typical tactics that employers in general use. So one of them is giving the workers just a little bit so they back off, so that $1. Another one is, like you mentioned, is threatening. The threat of saying, we might close, or we might just put more employment, we might shed employment and put it elsewhere in China. And so these so far have been the two kind of main tactics that come up. But as you said, I've not spoken to a Walmart kind of executive or a McDonald's executive and asked them about their strategy, which most likely they would, I mean, they would never say, of course. But so far, actually, in terms of adaptation, these are kind of the threat is a main one, and that often happens when workers try to organize. It's shown in research that one of the main reasons why it's so hard to organize workers is because the employer always threatens to close down the place. They don't do it, but the threat is the main, is one of the key factors of failure of organizing workers. And so besides these two, maybe we should indeed think outside the box and think what could they come up with and see if we could anticipate those new strategies, but I'm not sure. Yeah.
Well, there's always rolling the tanks into the main square and taking out the strikers, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, but Walmart did close down two Walmarts in Canada when they unionized, and they also took out their meat cutting group when they organized, right? So, I mean, so we have seen kind of the classic strategies. Let me hit you with a question that maybe is on other people's minds, too. The sustainability factor, those of us who come out of organized trade unions really always look at where's the dues dollar, i.e., where is the income revenue stream that keeps it going. So if you have a big friend like SEIU or, in their self-interest, UFCW, that's one thing, but sooner or later, somebody is going to assume that an organizational form has to, in effect, pay for itself somehow through either dues income or whatever. Otherwise, it continues to be, as the old phrase goes, a poor people's movement.
Definitely.
Okay. Comment on that?
That's a good point. And I talked, for example, to the David Rolf, he's the international vice president of the SEIU, and he would argue that what they're trying to actually build and promote is this new kind of workers' organization, but indeed to make it sustainable, you need a funding kind of system, a dues-based system. And so that has been shown, for example, in worker centers, that that's often a critical component that is lacking. And so what worker centers try to do is that saying that even though you earn very little, we still want you to pay, not all of them do it, but a lot of them do it, we still want you to pay some dues. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is that they, you know, they get resources, but the another reason is also that they get buy-in, or in the sense there's some ownership from the people that are part of the worker center. Because they pay it, then they feel ownership and they're part of it. But it's a good question, John, and it's part of the how do we make it sustainable, where do funding come from, and then it will be indeed, I think the model will be, if you want to be part of this, you need to pay dues, no matter how little you earn.
Laura?
Yeah, actually, I think that's an excellent point. So far, I have not seen any of that, but it's also true that if you look at the data, that often these franchisees, these small employers, are often struggling also, because they need to pay a huge fee to McDonald's, and if they can't maintain a model in which there's very the cost of the product is very low, the wages are so low, and then there's a lot of turnover, less productivity, and so on. That might actually be kind of a strategy that, you know, would be good for this movement, to see how can we actually work together with these franchisees, because they might be in an equally bad shape as we are. It's the big McDonald's that reaps all the benefits, but not us. So far, I have not encountered any of that, but that's a really good point. Yeah, so actually one of these one-day strikes was held globally, in which kind of the global union for food, I remember it, it's probably IUF, kind of also helped coordinate with various unions across countries to come out that day on strike, and so, or to come out and show actually solidarity with the U.S. workers. And so the interesting part here is that workers in Denmark, for example, that worked at a McDonald's, they were astonished by the low wages and the bad working conditions in the U.S. So they weren't striking, they were just showing their support and saying, we actually have it good here, and that's because of legislation, regulation that is in place, but we acknowledge and we find it horrible that our brothers back at McDonald's in the US are working under these circumstances. So that's in a way how the global aspect comes in there. So they're trying to work on that. Another thing is sometimes they try to bring workers over from different countries and will try to push at shareholder meetings. That's another aspect of how kind of they will try to form international campaigns and push the push certain issues through at shareholders meetings or hold demonstrations there to show it's not just in the US, but we should see it. We should see our power from a global aspect.
Other, I have to mention that the fact that Walmart decided to start Black Friday at 6 o'clock Thursday night on Thanksgiving, I think that they're the ones that did it at 6 o'clock Thursday night. You know, I mean, it was a major kind of fiasco because I'm so dual. On the one side, you know, we have to collect food for our then we turn around and force people to actually come in early for Black Friday at during the actual Thanksgiving holiday. I mean, it was a major major kind of public relations disaster, I think, for them.
Exactly. And in addition to that, I mean, it's shown that Walmart is kind of double dipping in a way. They give very low wages to the workers who then rely on food stamps, who then use those food stamps at Walmart to buy their products.
Well, and what you're really raising is the classic Keynesian problem, that in effect, not only are these low wage workers, but they're also low paid consumers.
Yeah.
And so they can only afford to
Exactly.
eat at McDonald's and
exactly.
only afford to shop at Walmart.
Right.
Right. So I mean, it's a vicious cycle.
Exactly.
Other questions, Dorothy?
Yes. Going back to that graph that you showed, beginning of the month, rich people are in fourth place. My question is, in calculating that, do they have any way to take into account the numbers being given out in the millions for people who are in the United States illegally?
So the argument is that it's even worse than reflected on the graph.
I'm not sure, actually. I should have a look at the data. And maybe someone knows here how this is, who counts in those statistics. I know they look at income, and so I'm not sure if it matters whether if they just look at the income. But if you're if it's not taxed or you're not, how do you say that? It's not reported, and so you work illegally, that might just not be in there, and so it might then be worse. But I'm not 100, I would assume it's like that, but does anyone
I'm not sure, but EPI,
know?
The Economic Policy Institute, would probably be, they're one of us, so they would have a tendency to try to make sure that they understood inequality in all of its meanings. They would probably go, I mean, I think that they're smart enough to go beyond BLS, but maybe not, because you were quoting EPI on this.
Yeah, one of them was, no, but that one was OECD, actually.
Well, oh, okay.
That one was just from the OECD, and what they look at is income after taxes or transfers.
Yeah.
So since they say income after taxes, I would assume that they just look at the reported income from people, and so that often workers that are undocumented and don't have that IRS statement or anything, that might not be counted under that, so they might be worse even, yeah.
Other questions? Yes.
Sure, that's a good point. And the survey was done, they looked at several elements. So there's not just one way of wage theft, but there are different dimensions. So one of them might be, for example, you have to check out, or like you stop the clock, but you continue working. So that's one example. Or you do overtime and it's not paid for. So there are different dimensions of wage theft.
Let me ask you a question, just because you've probably thought about this. By raising the wages preemptively, like they're doing, you know, all of us who learned, you know, revolution from Brinton's book, Anatomy of Revolution, where he said that things People don't revolt when things are at their worst. They revolt when things are getting better but not fast enough. Okay? So the question is, do you believe from your research that workers will be placated, or do you believe that workers will take that in some way as a not necessarily meeting expectation and therefore actually begin to organize harder?
Yeah, it's a good point. It reminds me of when I was in London doing similar research. One of the cleaners was telling me that, you know, managers, they come in here and they say, you know, I give you a 15-cent wage raise. And so they expected applause from us. And so he stood up and said, you know, for me, you know what that is? That is like that we're all in a desert and you have a big bucket of water and you just stick your finger in it and just give me one drop and that's it. And so in that case, it was for sure that, you know, this symbolic kind of action of management actually pushed workers to revolt or fight much harder against managers because they knew they can give us a lot more and they just try to quiet us down. And so I would hope, and I would think, let's not say hope, I would think that it's similar in the Walmart case or the McDonald's or the fast food case, and I think that unions try to also push through that message is that this is not going to stop us, but we should now fight harder because, see, they are responding to our actions. We can do better than that. And so we want not just bread but roses too, kind of right. That kind of spirit.
And since there's a number of us in the room that are all labor educators or labor activists and lawyers and other things, the one question that really the historic analog to this is the industrial workers of the world. Mm-hmm. Who, you know, had a number of unsustained organizations, yeah. But then when ultimately the law was passed, many of us, I think, probably have gone too far one way, which is to believe in majority unionism. But the law never believed in majority unionism. The law instead, the 35 Act and the 33 Act before it, really believed that workers could negotiate as long as two or more of them stood together, concerted activity, which this really means. So do you actually believe, you know, that in effect one way to see this go forward is for blockbusting, actually taking out individual McDonald's and ultimately getting majority status and whatever, or do you believe that this will always be kind of a minority unionism associational kind of alternative that is not going to see ultimately any form of contract, any form of actual regularized collective bargaining or anything else?
Yeah, it's a good point. And I'm not sure, but I don't think that when I talk to community organizers or some of the trade unionists behind this movement, I don't think that they even believe, and their point is not unionize, even though that's one of their demands officially. Their point is not unionization per se, and that's not what they go for, to unionize a certain Walmart, but it's really being part of a broader movement of workers and trying to push it through that way, even though that has a lot of disadvantages to it. And so one way is, as David Rolf was trying to tell me, is that they're trying to create these alternative forms of worker organizations with a sustainable funding base, but that can still demand better working and living conditions from the employer or from policymakers.
Mm-hmm. Other John? Oh. No, John. Then over to Peter.
Mm-hmm. We're very
Yeah.
And so if that's the case, then this is incredibly important and successful, and not going to be unsuccessful.
Yeah, yeah. No, those are all good points, and thank you for those comments. Just on the last one, so it's with the minority unionism, as I see it, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's still tricky because indeed you can, of course, form a group and be represented by a group, but the employer does not have to recognize you, right? So you're not. And so, for example, what happened in Chattanooga recently with Volkswagen is that there, the UAW lost the election, and it's now actually a minority unionism in place. So it's a small group that is in place, and it's maybe one of the examples that could show us what can happen when you have kind of that workers group in place.
The employer is not barred from negotiating, though.
No, they're not barred, but they don't need to.
Well, but if you throw a picket line up around the McDonald's, then they have to decide, you know, as long as you still have all of your Section 7 rights, mm-hmm. in terms of being able to bring pressure on the employer can decide easily that he or she is not going to put up with the abuse and therefore will talk even to a minority of people if they don't have majority status. Plus, the minority still has Section 7 concerted activity rights, which means they can't be fired for organizing. You know, they can't be fired for standing up. They can't be fired for picketing, right? But I mean, but getting them back, I mean, the problem is the actual remedies under the law. But I guess I'm just reacting to the idea that we automatically kind of relax and feel terrible once we lose a majority status battle.
Yeah.
When we actually have a lot of tools available to the people that just lost that battle.
Yeah.
But I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, John or Bruce or anybody or our law student or anybody else, I think that's always been my understanding, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, that's.
Yeah.
But how many. Definitely. There's definitely regional variation here in the U.S. If you compare, for example, New York City or places in North Carolina, it's very different. And in terms of France, they call it the French paradox. Like the density is, I think it's about 7% now. But in fact, they do have a lot of power. One of the reasons for that is because the collective bargaining agreements are held not at a firm level, but at a sectoral or national level. So almost 100% of the workers are actually covered by these agreements. Another reason is, of course, because of their history, kind of thinking even back to the Industrial Revolution and kind of their, I don't know how to say it, like the fighting spirit, every time you go to France, there might be a strike, and there are tons of people on the street. So that's definitely true. Their power is not only reflected in just this percentage of union density, but we need to go beyond that or look beyond that.
Peter?
Still relates back to the economic
Yeah. No, but sorry, your point is definitely well taken. So one, there can be, as we've seen in manufacturing, there's outsourcing or offshoring, so really shedding the employment here domestically and creating jobs or sending those jobs abroad, often to Southeast or Asia. Another tactic is indeed, or what is happening is also franchising in a way, could be seen as, again, fragmentizing that employment relationship, and rather than outsourcing, you franchise, the franchise model in a way gives, again, a lot of power to a big corporation, and then, but they're not held liable for any of the working conditions of these employees that happens and the franchisees. I mean, what I would just add is that on the technology part, for example, Thomas Friedman in his book, The World is Flat, talking about how with globalization everyone has kind of similar, we're all equal, and you know, if you're born in Vietnam, Bangladesh, or US, we all have the same opportunities because of the internet, because of technology, and so on. Well, whether you believe that or not, anyway, it doesn't matter what I believe about that. But one of the points is that he made is that, for example, even with a McDonald's, if you drive to the drive-thru and you say what you want, that now could happen that someone in India or in China gets that message and then make sure that gets back to making the dinners ready. So there is, even in places like fast food, options for even more automated technology or for offshoring certain positions that we never even thought of. And the final comment that I would say is that what I've seen a lot in Europe is that for those jobs that cannot be outsourced, what the employer often does is they have migrant workers do that work and paying them very low labor. And they, I forget the term of it, but it's something like, the point is that it's not offshoring, it stays domestically, but it's in an equally bad position as if it would be offshoring. And so what unions then try to do is saying that we need to stand up for all workers, for migrant workers and our workers, we need to just raise those standards, because otherwise everyone suffers.
But Peter's point, it's interesting, isn't it, that we used to say, those of us who are leftists in the room, that we have to worry about the means of production, now we have to worry about the means of consumption. Mm-hmm. So we, I mean, what SEIU has argued for years is you have to organize who can't move, you have to organize who's left. But the one problem is, to Peter's point, in late capitalism, a lot of the stuff is unsustainable. It's problematic in terms of what the U.S. economy looks like as more and more of us age, as we expect workers who are working in rest homes or in kind of extended care facilities to work for nothing, we end up with compressed wages to the bottom. And the one thing these people have in common is that if I'm not working at McDonald's, I very well may be working at some assisted care facility, or I'll jump from there and work at Walmart. I mean, in effect, yeah, the lateral movement among the precarious working class is really quite amazing, and that wage inequality continues to put more and more power in very few hands, right? And the disappearing middle kind of thing. So yeah. I mean, it's really interesting to see where we're going with all that.
Definitely, and like, I'm always kind of flabbergasted or shocked, honestly, when I talk about some of these issues with my students or in my class. There's always at least one person who would argue, why should they earn $15 per hour? If I, you know, I have student debt, I come out of college and I just earn $20 per hour, why should they have that much? And so if we keep on thinking in that kind of rhetoric, rather than thinking why, you know, should the CEO get that much money, or, you know, because they feel like, I don't know. Anyway, let's not expand on this, but I think the point is that if we think that having a system in which fast food workers earn so little that they have to rely on food stamps and thinking that's okay, then there's something really wrong with where we're heading to.
Well,
excellent point about campaigning, the innovation, the originality of
Yeah.
With, you only have to read the replies from what I've seen as to every journalistic article that follows, is that they're sort of using this common nonsensical sort of thing, and those ideas can have a big impact on ordinary people. Some kind of idea like that is picked up on the shop floor and then spread through rumor or gossip or conversation. And so the ability of organized labor or the actual workers themselves to find the organizers to be able to put forward very commonsensical alternative opinions that make sense. Throughout history has been this slogan, you know, living wage and so on and so forth. So I think that will also be very important in terms of the communication of these ideas. Every morning on the bus I look at people, you know, looking at their hand and wondering what it is they're reading, and sometimes they're looking at addresses and sometimes they're looking at news. But for the organised labour and other organised labour to be able to tweet, to be able to push these messages out is a great challenge, because that then opens up the idea of wider coalitions. But it's going to be a very strenuous effort, I think.
Yeah.
Well, in one sense, it's open, because in the past, I would have been looking at, say, workers reading a newspaper, and what they were reading would be pretty much set from above. So theoretically, it's more open. But then who's now controlling? The Murdochs and others are now controlling a lot of that flow. So very intriguing new battles.
Exactly. Yeah, the battle of ideas is crucial, and also the power of the mess of bringing the message, the narrative, the power in naming who's the employer, who's not. All these issues are very, very important, and play a big role.
Let's give Amanda another round of applause.
Thank you.
What a wonderful talk. Please do come back for Peter Cole 2 weeks from today, talking about Longshore in South Africa and in the United States. And if you haven't signed in, sign in, please. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you, everyone. I really enjoyed the discussion. Thanks.